Kidd filling in for Jeff Rentz tonight. He is taking the night off for a special event, and I'm happy to fill in for him for the next 2 hours. And the producer's going to let me know about my headset here. Hopefully the sound is good. We did a sound check. Very pleased and honored tonight to have a dear friend of mine for the guest for the show tonight, Dr. Edwin Vieira. I know an awful lot of you know about Edwin, but for those of you who don't know his background, he holds 4 degrees from Harvard, an AB from Harvard College, AM and PhD, Harvard Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and a JD from Harvard Law School. For more than 30 years, and it's probably closer to 35 now, Edwin has practiced law with the emphasis on constitutional issues. In the Supreme Court of the United States, he successfully argued or briefed the cases leading to landmark decisions, Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, Chicago Teachers Union v. Hudson, and Communication Workers of America v. Beck, which established constitutional and statutory limitations on the uses to which labor unions in both the private and public sectors may apply fees that are extracted from non-union workers as the condition of their employment. He is also truly a gifted writer. He's written countless monologues and articles in scholarly journals. He's lectured throughout the country. He wrote a magnificent piece of work called Pieces of Eight, which is once again going to be available in print, should win a Pulitzer Prize in economics. The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution, that's Pieces of Eight. He also wrote a fabulous book, and I should say tome, because it's like, I don't know, 1,500 pages, called Crashmaker. It's a not-so-fictional story of an engineered crash of the Federal Reserve System and the political upheaval it causes. Fast forward, that book was written in 2000. He also wrote a book I think everybody should read, How to Dethrone the Imperial Judiciary, and Volume 1, The Nation in Arms on Constitutional Homeland Security, is his most recent. He is now working on, and I think getting close to completing, Volume 2. So having gone through all of that, good evening, Edwin.
Very glad to be with you, Dee Dee. How are you?
Oh, I'm okay, and it's my pleasure. And I know that you've been on so many radio shows, but just because I hate to do this, when you hear the music, it means we're going to break, because when I had my show, I would always have to cut in and say, stop talking! We're going to break. So anyway, when the producer starts the music, we're going to take an important break for sponsors, because without the sponsors, Jeff's show would not remain on the air. Okay, for the first part of the show, first hour, I want to talk about the issue of the day, to me, to you, and has been for you for a long, long time. And I'm talking about the foremost problem contributing significantly, and these are your words, to almost every economic difficulty now plaguing this country, is the inherent and ineradicable instability of the present monetary and banking system centered around the Federal Reserve. We know that Ron Paul now has chairmanship of a committee, but it's not so easy, is it, Edwin?
No, not at the level of Congress, certainly, because they have a number of problems besides the political one. Obviously, the first problem is to get enough people convinced that something has to be done, and then secondly, to get them convinced of what in particular has to be done. But that's the major difficulty, is the what in particular can be done, given that the entire economy, obviously for a very long time, has been dependent upon and used to using this Federal Reserve bank currency. And so we have all of our prices denominated in this. We have all sorts of contracts, short-term and especially long-term contracts, which are, if they're not denominated directly in Federal Reserve notes, they're denominated in dollars, and under the way the banking laws and monetary laws work, those would be interpreted to mean that they were intended to be paid in Federal Reserve note currency. The entire credit structure of the market clearly is built upon this banking cartel that's been out there since 1914, that period. So you can't simply, as some people suggest, disestablish or repeal the Federal Reserve System without taking into consideration the effects of that. And the first thing that has to be laid on the table is, if you remove the Federal Reserve System in some way, Of course, you're removing the currency and credit structure of the country, and with what do you replace it? And obviously, you have to replace it at least simultaneously, and I would say quite a bit in advance of making any major reductions, let's say, in the presence or the power of the Federal Reserve System, because you have to give the free market the opportunity to absorb this new currency and equilibrate all the various prices that are out there in terms of it. Because the other alternative, of course, is doing it essentially from the top down and trying to impose some new currency on the system, and then you run into what's called the problem of the irrationality of central economic planning, because that's what brought down the Soviet Union, every kind of centrally bureaucratically controlled economic system has an inherent intellectual flaw in it, the inability to calculate prices rationally. So you can't operate that way. So there are people out there who are talking as if it were like turning on a light bulb or turning off a light bulb or changing a light bulb for that matter, and that something can be done with the Federal Reserve System overnight. And the short answer to that is, well, for all intents and purposes, it's impossible. It would lead to an extremely chaotic situation, and then we can imagine what the political repercussions of that would be. So we have to start looking at the thing. Ron Paul is going in the right direction, at least with respect to this concept of seriously auditing, inquiring into is what I would really call it, inquiring into the way the Federal Reserve has been operating and the principles of operation and the effects of these things. And that will create a great deal, number one, of public understanding of what really is going on behind the scenes. And I think that will lead, secondarily, to a great deal of public revulsion with the way this system has been operating and what it was really essentially set up to do. This was a system that was designed to help the big banks and the financial powerhouses, basically in New York City and Chicago, and that's the short answer of it. Everybody else, you know, the devil takes the hindmost in that system. So I think when people realize that, there'll be much more of a clamor to do something about the Federal Reserve, but then we come back to the practical problem of how that can be done. And my proposal for a long time has been, well, we've got to go back to those political entities that we, the people, can actually control. At the present time, it's not Congress. It's the state legislatures, or at least some of the state legislatures. And we can use the state system, the federal system, at the state level, if you will, to inject into the marketplace a new and stable currency, simultaneously with the continuous use of Federal Reserve currency, so that we will generate a competitive system of currencies. And if the new currency that's introduced is more stable than the Federal Reserve currency, and that doesn't say much for it, right? It doesn't have to be too much more stable to be more stable than the thing they have now. Then you would see all the forces of the free market working to cause people to move away from the Federal Reserve System to the new currency. And that in and of itself would begin to diminish the role and the power of the Federal Reserve in the economy. And if enough states took that course, then you would see tremendous economic pressure on Congress to follow along, number one. And number two, Congress would be given essentially the template or the plan for doing it. All they have to do essentially is at the federal level adopt the same type of competitive introduction of the new currency as had been adopted at the state level. And then you might very well see within a reasonable length of time the Federal Reserve System essentially fading away. And those banks that could, the ones that are out there now, the so-called member banks in the Federal Reserve System, commercial banks, the ones of those that could use the new currency, adopt the new currency, they would do so. The ones that couldn't eventually would go under, they go bankrupt, they'd have to be liquidated. You have a big shakeup in the banking system. But the entire economy would gradually, and maybe not so, you know, so slowly, I mean, I say gradually, but step by step, it may be a relatively short period of time, move away from Federal Reserve currency to the new currency. So that's the proposal that I've been laying out there. And the interesting thing is, I've never heard anyone really critique this. I've never heard anyone say, well, that couldn't possibly work.
I haven't seen or read anything from anybody, like you say, especially state legislators, and there are so many of them that are aware of the proposal that you've laid out for so many years, because you've been at this a long time, especially up in the state of New Hampshire. And Ron Paul said the same thing you did about 5 minutes ago, that this has to be done step by step. He came right out and said, you cannot abolish the central banking system with a snap of your fingers. He's mm-hmm. going to go into this as, number one, inquiry and audit, hopefully, and second of all, to raise the level of understanding with the American people about the disabilities of this monetary fiat currency system and proceed from there. So, you know, I know there's people out there who just think, wow, gee whiz, we can get rid of it tomorrow. But like you say, it can't. And also, as you were just going into, and we can go pick it up on the other side, I think I hear the music, about the fact that it hasn't been critiqued or analyzed in the way that it should be, and you would think in this current environment that it would be. So, don't go away, everybody. We'll be right back after our important breaks. Welcome back from the break. This is DV filling in for Jeff tonight, and our guest is Dr. Edwin Vera. And before we went to the break, Edwin was just talking about the fact that nobody seems to be taking apart or discussing the proposal about an alternative currency. And I forgot to mention one other publication that you've written, and I have it, and I recommend it all the time. It's a practical guide for gold clauses and the use of gold, because a lot of people don't understand. You know, they say, well, I can't haul around 4 or 5 ounces of gold in my pocket. So I highly recommend that. I think probably this is a good time to segue into the fact that besides the state of New Hampshire, I'm looking at your testimony that you gave on March 11, 2009. It was pertaining to a bill number 639 in the Montana State Legislature. Mm-hmm. You testified in front of their committee about this alternative system. Could you please go into that?
Well, New Hampshire and Montana aren't the only states. There was a similar bill put in Indiana. I think there was one put in Colorado. And
right.
So they're floating around. Montana actually held a committee hearing at which witnesses testified. I testified, Dr. Lawrence Parks from New York, James Turk, and actually we had G. Edward Griffin there online, but they ran out of time in the hearing, so he didn't have an opportunity to testify. And unfortunately, it was one of those situations where the committee voted, I think it was 9-9, exact mm-hmm. Democrat-Republican split. Although this, of course, is not a partisan issue by any stretch of the imagination, but it went that way. So the bill died in committee. Now, I understand that the folks up there in Montana will be reasserting or revivifying or whatever. They're putting that bill back in. So we may see a little more action on it now, especially since things have obviously gotten worse even since 2009. It's interesting, though, because the original New Hampshire bill was put in somewhere around 2005, 2006. So it really was a preview, the bill, of what was about to break out in the markets. But those folks up there didn't, you know, they weren't paying attention. I mean, people apparently need to have the screws tightened very much before they really pay attention to remedies to these problems.
Yes,
that's been my experience.
Back in 2005, you wrote, I think it was your second column for News with Views, back in 2005, you opened right up, full guns blazing, about, you know, the government's not going to bail you out when there's a financial collapse that's coming. And they, not all the legislators, but so many of them, like you say, they simply are ignoring what the whole world knows and aren't paying attention. And then they get slapped in the face with the financial problems that the states are having. They're severe. I mean, they're severe when you look at the state of California. They can't sell and rustle off enough money just to pay the pension obligations every month. So, anyway, please go ahead.
Well, no, they're going to have, those people with these huge pension liabilities are going to have great difficulty, and they're probably going to have to end up renegotiating those pension contracts to reduce the level of liability. But, the main problem here, fundamentally, going back to the what I would call a foundational point, is your currency economically sound and politically insulated from manipulation? If it's not both of those, and usually if it's politically subject to manipulation, then it won't be economically sound. So you have to have those two. Now, we have a system here where the currency would not be sound even if you didn't have involvement of the government, because you're dealing with a fractional reserve banking cartel. But you also have the direct relationship of the government to that cartel. So it's the worst of all possible worlds. The idea with the alternative currency is to put in a stable currency, stable because it is separate from and actually impossible to have governmental manipulation of it, because it's tied directly to two commodities, silver and gold, and therefore tied directly into the market system. Once you have that, then other reforms can be built on it in the same way that, you know, you have to have a foundation before you can build the walls of a house, put the windows in, put the roof on, or whatever. If the foundation isn't there, forget about the rest of the structure. And this is the problem we have. The whole monetary and banking structure is rotten, primarily because its foundation is rotten. Now, a lot of other rotten things have been done at the first floor level and the second floor level and, you know, the roof level, but fundamentally it's because the foundation is rotten. So it's really counterproductive to be talking about tinkering with those first floor and second floor problems when the ultimate problem is the weakness, the crumbling of the foundation. Now, your difficulty at the state level is the political difficulty, and this has been my experience, I think it's probably yours too, I have run into state legislators, and their first reaction to this type of proposal is, well, it's not going to happen. We're not going to have such a breakdown that we have to worry about this. You know, denial. It's not going to happen. Once you get them past that, because the figures are already out there, and they're getting worse almost, you know, every week, once you get them past the denial level, the argument is, well, this really isn't a problem for the states to handle. This is a problem for Washington to handle, for the Federal Reserve to handle, for the Treasury Department. And, of course, then I point out to them, well, who caused this problem in the first place if it wasn't Washington? How do you expect Washington to give you the solution when Washington is the source of the problem? All right. Then third argument is, well, we don't have the authority. Kind of a legal argument. Well, they haven't read the U.S. Constitution. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, right? Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1. And the Supreme Court actually ruled on this particular point of an alternative currency twice in the late 1800s. Remember, you had circulating in the country at that time the so-called Lincoln Greenbacks, the legal tender Treasury notes that had been put out during the Civil War. They were not redeemable in gold at that time because the government was simply not redeeming them. All right? They became redeemable in 1875. Well, in this period of non-redeemability, first state that did it was state of Oregon. State of Oregon had a requirement that its taxes had to be collected in gold and silver coin.
Okay, we'll pick this up right on the other side of the break, so don't go away, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with Dr. Vieira. Welcome back from the break. This is Evie Kidd, and I'm filling in for Jeff tonight. We're very, very happy to have Dr. Edwin Vieira as our guest. My new column is posted on my website. It is on the effort to recall Senator Robert Menendez out of the state of New Jersey. And as I predicted last June, the New Jersey Supreme Court shot it down. So you might want to check that out. It's not posted on Jeff's website yet because he has taken the night off. So check it out at dv.com. Before we went to the break, Edwin, you were talking, going back in history a little bit about the Greenbacks, 1875, and non-redeemability. So
right.
We can pick it up from there.
And the problem then was that arose in this one particular case, went to the Supreme Court, that the state of Oregon was collecting taxes in gold and silver coin pursuant to a state statute. And some, essentially taxpayers, were making the claim that they were entitled to pay those taxes with these Lincoln Greenbacks, which were declared to be legal tender by Congress. Goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, wrong, Congress can declare these things legal tender for the purpose of individual dealings or for the purpose of the federal government, but it cannot tell the states, because they retain certain sovereign governmental authority, cannot tell the states what they will use as their own currency for the purpose of performing their governmental function. So, clearly, every state today has the constitutional ability, because it is a state, as well as a specific statement in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, to choose to use an alternative currency in preference to, or perhaps even to the exclusion of, Federal Reserve currency. So, the state authority is there. The next problem that you run into with the state legislator is, well, they're just not familiar with the use of alternative currencies, not familiar with the mechanism. They're not like the Europeans. You know, they were able to put in the euro system because all of those countries were in close economic relationships, and they were, most Europeans were used to dealing in more than one currency, so it was pretty easy to put in the euro as a kind of competing or alternative currency and then phase out the national currencies as they did and come up with a single European, new European currency. Unfortunately, Americans don't have that kind of experience, especially the state legislators, so that's the next problem we run into. You have to educate them about the kind of the how-to aspect of this. And for people who want to see how the most technologically advanced method functions, go take a look at something like goldmoney.com, which is James Turk's operation, and you'll see how an electronic gold, electronic silver system works. And there are other people out there that are working on these kinds of methods. So it's there. The technology is out there, provided that the legislators will simply sit down and read a little bit about it. And it can be put into effect right now. I mean, theoretically, places like Gold Money or Sovereign States Depository, there are a number of these that are out there, could actually be hired as essentially an outside contractor by the state to provide this service, or the state could license that technology and run the operation itself. So we're not talking about something that's pie in the sky here, Davey. This is here right now. The states have the ability to do it. They have the constitutional authority to do it. It's pretty obvious they're going to have the extreme need to do it if this Federal Reserve System, what shall we say, collapses in a hyperinflationary-type event, which a lot of people certainly are predicting on the basis of the numbers that are out there, these astronomical debt loads that are out there. Yeah. So we may see one of those situations where the states really have no choice. And what I have been trying to do is to go around to them and say, look, if you're looking far enough down the road and you see that there's this major problem, now is the time, if you're prudent, to begin taking action. Don't wait until you get to the edge of the cliff and about to go over. Do it now so that to the greatest extent you may be able to avoid that calamity. So there's the final difficulty is, even if you lay all of this out, there's a certain amount of lethargy or friction or whatever you want to call it, a reluctance of these people to finally, as it were, bite the bullet and pass some kind of legislation. And I mean, some of them have actually told me, oh, I don't know whether we can do this because, you know, we'd appear to be fringe. The media would go after us and we'd, you know, we'd look bad. I thought to myself, oh my God, you think you're not going to look worse when the monetary system, the Federal Reserve component of it collapses and you're left in the state of whatever without a functioning currency? Which is worse? What some fool says about you on the 6 o'clock news, or being in that chaotic situation with no ability to deal with it?
Not to mention the fact that it's their responsibility and their duty to protect and, as you, in your own words, advance the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of the state. And right at the top of the list is the economic well-being.
Well, I think that's right. In fact, if you take a look at the Department of Homeland Security is a good example of this. Take a look at their website, and they have descriptions on there of the different types of homeland security issues that they're looking at. And one of them is this economic security issue. And we certainly know that the armed forces out there, and you can find this pretty easily on the web, that the armed forces out there for a number of years have been war gaming, if you will, or gaming the scenarios of what they would have to do to come in and restore stability in the course of a major economic breakdown. So these things are on the table at the planning stage of those people in Washington, either in the Homeland Security Department or in the Pentagon, because anyone with half a brain understands that the present banking system is extremely fragile. And if it comes down, especially in a hyperinflationary type environment, a la, you know, the Weimar experience in Germany, you will have a tremendous amount, not only of economic dislocation, but of social and political dislocation following on that immediately. And how are you going to restore order in those circumstances? And my point has always been, let's not wait until we get there, ladies and gentlemen. If that's the concern, if that's the fear, and we certainly are justified in being concerned about it, then we need to take the preparative steps now. And actually, if we take those steps soon enough, we may actually stabilize this whole system. If enough states did this, and especially if you could eventually convince Congress to do it, we could stabilize this system. Because you could move a vast amount of the market away from the Federal Reserve, the collapsing Federal Reserve system. So it's all a matter, I think, of really of getting that, the snowball rolling downhill, getting that first impetus out of some state legislature somewhere. They pass one of these bills, they make it work, and then everybody else looks at that and says, that's what we need to do.
Well, that's
because
what they
get to do. There's no alternative.
There is no alternative. And look at this, going back to California, they're issuing all these IOUs as a substitute for payment of their bills. And I'm going, how do they legally do this? And are the other states looking? Oh, yeah, well, we hear about the stuff out of the state of the nuts and the fruits. Well, guess what, folks? Look at the state of Illinois. Look at the state of New Jersey. I mean, these states are tens of billions of dollars in the hole just to meet pension requirements.
That's right.
We'll be back from our break in just a moment, so please don't go away. Welcome back. This is Phoebe with Dr. Edwin Vieira. That's our last break before the top of the hour, but Edwin has graciously agreed to stay on for the next hour because we're going to talk about two things, and I want to get this out before I go back to Edwin, and I will post the information on my website probably by noon tomorrow. My webmaster will get it done because I know sometimes on the radio it's hard to write all this down, but there is a, I believe it's four discs, 8 hours long. It's called The Purse and the Sword. It is Edwin Vieira. He is speaking live at the Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. He speaks about the purse, which we've talked about this hour, and the sword, the imminent dangers of the U.S. economic and homeland security policies. I urge everybody, get a copy of it and play it for yourself. I have a friend who lives in another part of the state of Texas. And every week at a community meeting, they play one of the discs, people watch it, and then they talk about it afterwards. This is what needs to happen in all over the country. And get a copy and send it to your state representative and your state senator with a polite letter asking them to please watch this, because the economic collapse is a very, very real possibility. This is not some fun and games or conspiracy theory. People are going to be wiped out. Americans are suffering by the millions and millions. And all of this goes back to the purse and the sword. As Patrick Henry said, once it's gone, you cannot get it back. So I said that. If you can't get to my website tomorrow, by the way, the purse and the sword can be ordered from www.heritageresearchinstitute.org. Heritageresearchinstitute.org. I don't know how Edwin did it. It's a magnificent presentation, and it answers all the questions anybody could have. He speaks about the complexities of the economic system, but it's an easy language for even people like me to understand. So that's my recommendation. Edwin, before the top of the hour news break, when you're talking about the states and adopting a parallel monetary system, you're talking about electronically, is that correct? How they would implement this?
Yes, and that's the beauty of this new so-called electronic gold or electronic silver system. It's the technological cutting edge. There's no need to deal directly with coinage. People can get coinage out of the system if they want to hold that themselves. But fundamentally, it works on the basis of electronically transferring ownership interests in actual gold or actual silver that's held in a depository. So it enables us to use not only the speed and the accuracy that can be generated with one of these computer control systems, but now for the first time we can actually make the gold and silver system work, because we can pay very, very small amounts of gold or silver electronically. James Turk's system, for instance, is using a gram as his unit, and I think he's capable now of running that system so that it will pay a thousandth of a gram. Well, that's an extremely small amount of purchasing power, especially if it's a thousandth of a gram of silver. So now you can actually make very, very small change with gold and silver in the system. So this is probably the first time in world history that a gold and silver, exclusively gold and silver monetary system can really work technologically, because we're capable of making payments at essentially any level of purchasing power to be transmitted. Plus, of course, having it all computerized enables you to keep every kind of record you can possibly imagine and do all sorts of calculations and all the rest of that can be built into the system. So it's a highly sophisticated method. And it can be set up very, very quickly because the technology is essentially already online. It's already out there. It's solely a question of setting up a depository for the actual gold and silver in the particular state. So we're looking at a system which, as I said before, was not by any stretch of the imagination pie in the sky, but our difficulty is education. So what I've been telling people right now is, sure, you can hand your state legislature a copy of one of these early bills, the New Hampshire bill or the Montana bill, and say, well, why don't you look at this? I think the first step to do, I'll give you an example. We have a provision here in the state of Virginia by which the House or the Senate, let's say the House can pass what they call a joint resolution to set up an advisory or an investigatory commission. And they put a certain number of people from the House on it, they put a certain number of people in the Senate on it, they give it a little bit of a budget to bring in witnesses and hold hearings, and they give it a timeline during which it has to conduct these hearings and come up with a report. And I think that's what people need to be looking at right now in terms of educating those legislators, number one. If you have this kind of a provision in your state law, whether it's within the legislature they set up one of these commissions, or perhaps they could set up a commission that was outside of the legislature, perhaps would have some people from the governor's office in it, and it would have the task of investigating this question of the desirability of that state adopting an alternative or parallel currency system. And then experts could be brought in, testimony could be taken, all of these facts could be laid on the table. And actually, I mean, we did this in Montana. Unfortunately, we had as I said before, we had this Republican-Democrat split, and so it was they made it a partisan issue. But there was some pretty powerful testimony. That was 2009. Well, now the testimony would be even more powerful because everything that was said then, the predictive nature, all came true. I mean, the problem we have with our monetary and banking system is it's a mechanism, and you can literally predict how it's going to fall apart. I like to make the analogy, it's a car with square wheels. If you drive a car with square wheels long enough, your automotive engineer will tell you, well, you're going to shake that front end loose, you're going to shake the differential loose, and you're going to destroy the transmission. No question that's going to happen. We simply can't tell you exactly when. It depends on how much wear and tear that car will take. But a certain sequence of events will occur, and we have been seeing those sequence of events. Well, I've been writing about this since the late 1970s in terms of the general prediction, and then more recently now it's the much more specific prediction of when this is coming, because we can see the breakdown elements and the elements in the system that are breaking down. So I think this is the first thing. People need to find those legislators who know how to put through one of these investigatory commissions. Get one of those things set up on the basis of the question of alternative currency. And once you have it, you'll be able to find the experts to come in and testify on it. And I think it'll be a one-sided case, that you won't find people on the other side saying, oh, no, we shouldn't do this. This is a bad idea. Let's not even think about it. Wrong. I don't think you'll find anyone that will sit down at the table and give that argument. All right? They may say, oh, well, we're not there yet. It may not be necessary. This is too early, that type of thing. But no one is going to be able to say that this isn't something that should be investigated very, very seriously. And, of course, the further along we go in the destruction of the Federal Reserve System, the more pressing it becomes. So that's my recommendation right now. Get that educational method set up in the state to educate those state legislators, number one. And number two, if you have that kind of a commission on this issue, it will get local media attention. And then it becomes an educational tool for the general public as well. And that's key, because if you don't have support of the general public behind this, the legislators are always going to run for cover.
That's
it's a controversial
right.
issue. They're always going to run for cover.
Not to mention the fact that so many of the legislatures are only in session for a short period of time, and we are running out of time. you have predicted, just going back to your Collins in 2005, you've laid it out step by step as so many other people have. And, you know, these legislators, I know that they, you know, have their agenda set, but if there's anything more important than making sure the financial stability of the state is, you know, on good ground, I can't think of what it is at this moment, because for certain, so many of them are crumbling right in front of our face. And here in Texas, we go back into session in January, only for 140 days, and then our legislature's gone until January of 2013, like several other states. Before we get to the news, just very quickly, I know that a lot of Americans, a lot of people who are internet, read columns who think the magic bullet, and I know you disagree with this, and so do I, but the magic bullet is to have state banks become the thing to cure the Federal Reserve and the monetary problems within the state. But, of course, as you said, it doesn't do any good if they're using Federal Reserve notes, right?
Well, that's the first problem. Any state bank that's operating within the Federal Reserve system,
yeah,
of using Federal Reserve currency, if that currency collapses in hyperinflation, that bank goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that that bank is going to evade the hyperinflationary effect if it's using that currency. So let's leave aside the merits of the banking question and just focus on the currency question. The only way you're going to have a stable state bank, and by that I take it people mean a bank that's actually owned and run by the state itself,
right,
is if that state bank is using a stable currency. I mean, that's obvious.
It is obvious to you and me, but not to a whole lot of people.
I think it's obvious to everybody, because the state banks that have been out there, a lot of people talk about the Bank of North Dakota. That bank was operating for many, many years before the Federal Reserve System currency began to come down. So you look at its record, you say, well, it had a fairly good record. Well, okay, because the currency was still stable. It would not have had that record in a hyperinflationary environment. It would have collapsed along with everything else, or was going to collapse when the Federal Reserve System comes down. So assuming that one wants to say, well, we're in favor of having a state bank, put that on the table, I say fine. But first step, or coincident step with setting up that bank, stable alternative currency.
It's like you said at the beginning of the show, it's called the house's foundation. Without the right foundation, it doesn't matter what you put on the top, it's still going to collapse.
That's right. So to set up a new state bank now, let's say in Montana, to set up a state bank based on the Federal Reserve note, and then, of course, the Federal Reserve System comes down, well, that bank comes down with it. So what was the point?
That's what I wanted you to bring out here before we go to the news break, that, you know, some of these quote, solutions aren't really solutions if you understand the real problem, and that is the currency itself. It doesn't matter if you house it in a state bank or, you know, the ABC bank up the street. If you're still using the currency that's going to implode and explode all over the place and, you know, be worthless, it doesn't matter what kind of building it's sitting in.
That's right. The Archangel Michael could not run a state bank on the Federal Reserve currency when that currency comes down.
Well, I truly wish, and I know you know about this, the legislative summit that's held every year. I think it's always in Philadelphia, but I'm not sure. But more than 6,000 state representatives, senators, and luminaries, they come together for 1 week. We're going to the news. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back from the break. If you're just joining us, I'll cut the music out there. If you're just joining us, this is DB Kidd. I'm filling in tonight for Jeff Rentz. He's taking the night off. Our special guest tonight is Dr. Edwin Vieira. And before I get back to Edwin, I lost track of things. I wanted to say, because we were talking about the power of the purse the last hour, that I wish that Edwin could speak, and it's possible, if he wanted to, at the legislative summit that comes up next year, because I do believe if you had him in front of 6,000 legislators, the whole idea of an alternative currency would be the hot ticket in town. Anyway, this second hour, we're going to talk about the second part, because to me, the power of the purse, the power of the sword, these are most important in the times that we live in. And to set that up, I need to take a minute or two here. Way back in 1997, I saved a newspaper, and it's scanned, and I'll post it tomorrow with the other items from the show so you can look at the link. This was in the Sacramento Bee in 1997, and when I saw the headlines, I almost fainted. Huge headlines. Huge, huge piece. It said, "Our civilian-military face-off. The next real war we're likely to fight will be on U.S. soil." And some Marines say they can see the day when the Corps will be required to execute Haiti-like missions, or worse, within the borders of the U.S. If you scan down a little bit farther into this massive piece, it says the Bill of Rights is no obstacle for the Marine Corps. And as you scroll down a little bit further, the gentleman who wrote this, he was a Timothy Reeves, titled U.S. Marine Corps and Domestic Peacekeeping, I love that, for the Marine Command and Staff College. He said, because, and this is 1997, because of the rising potential for civil disobedience within the inner cities, it is inevitable the U.S. military will be employed more often within American borders. Now, December 7th, The New American came out with another, with a piece about the U.S. military prepares for economic collapse. And this was based on a CNBC Business News report that the Defense Intelligence Establishment has been paying attention to the global markets, that the Army's launched an operation called Unified Quest 2011. How they think up these things, I don't know. But it would appear that the government is so worried about there isn't really an economic recovery going on, but that they fully expect something else to happen out there, and the way to control it is to bring down the military on the American people. So, we're going to talk about the power of the sword and the real meaning of the Second Amendment. So, welcome back to Dr. Vieira. Go ahead, Edwin.
Well, I would just suggest to people, go to newswithviews.com and take a look at my archive. And one of the earliest pieces that I started putting up on News with Views is entitled Homeland Security for What and for Whom. All right? And it was directed to this exact point, that the powers that be are perfectly well aware of the instability of this monetary and banking system that they've been running for so long. And they understand how these systems tend to shake themselves to pieces, and that the consequence of that is always some sort of economic, social, and political upheaval. And so the Homeland Security system, I saw very early on, was actually directed not towards international terrorism, which is the old gray mare, the cover story that they're putting out for us, because if they were really worried about that, they'd seal the Mexican border, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can drive 18-wheelers loaded with God knows what across that border and nothing happens. So it's not sealed. They're not interested in international terrorism. They are interested in dealing with the potential, very large potential, for massive social and political unrest when this house of cards in the banking and financial system comes down. And their problem, of course, is they can't control that. As I like to say, they're riding a tiger. The system has, in a sense, its own logic. And when it fails, it will fail, and it may do so very, very suddenly, because it's not simply a matter of internal events. We have external events as well. I mean, what the Chinese might do, or what the Russians might do, or what the Russians and the Chinese in tandem might do, could have terrific feedback effects into the monetary banking system here and really precipitate some kind of collapse. So if you're sitting there in Washington and looking at this system, you say, my God, we're facing the possibility of a complete political breakdown. We need to maintain our own position, and the way to do that is to use boots on the ground, as the expression goes, with the armed forces. Well, of course, the armed forces, to a large extent, are off in, 125 different places in the world, different countries in the world, National Guards off there with them. Even if they brought a lot of those people back in the course of some kind of major economic breakdown, I would think that many of them would be more concerned with their own well-being of their own families and their own communities than they would be in taking orders from Janet Napolitano. So it's a moot point, I think, whether these rather grandiose visions that some people have in Washington of a centralized, top-down control of a major breakdown throughout the United States using the armed forces or the National Guard, whether that would even work. Secondly, we've seen how competent these people are. I mean, Katrina gives you a good example of that. There was a predicted natural disaster, and they couldn't handle it. Right? They made a first-class mess of that. And that was localized in space and in time, really. And they still, and they knew it was coming. And it was the kind of disaster that they had prepared for in the past, at least on paper. And they were incapable of doing a competent job. So what are they going to do if the entire monetary and banking system comes down, transportation breaks down, food delivery breaks down? You know, you draw your own pictures of the scenario. I don't care what plans they have in the Pentagon. They're not going to work. And they're especially not going to work because we're facing the same kind of problem that's caused this monetary and banking problem. It's the old argument critique, the impossibility of rational economic calculation. You have a major breakdown in the American economy, and the only way you're going to be able to deal with it is from the local level up, not from the top down. Why? Because the local level is where the people are. The local level is where the resources are. The local level is where people know what resources they have, what resources they need, how to allocate what it is they have to the particular problems that are facing them. By the time that kind of information gets to Janet Napolitano, it's hours, days, weeks old. And then by the time she tries to figure out what to do with it, it's months old. That kind of system does not function. So if you, in the long run, if you have a major nationwide breakdown, the idea that they are going to be able to restore economic stability and social stability from some top-level offices in the Pentagon is absolute nonsense. That will not happen. What does the Constitution tell us? You know, when in danger, read the book of instructions. You're driving down the road, the car starts to knock and it goes and slides off the road. Get out and look at the book of instructions. The United States Constitution, in the Second Amendment, tells us what is necessary for homeland security. That's the only place in the Constitution where the word security is used. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And notice the connection. It's not security in general. It's not the security of some kind of a police state. It's the security of a free state, which is the ultimate goal of the whole constitutional structure, to maintain a free political society. Well, there's the Constitution telling us this is the thing that's necessary. And in fact, it's the only thing that the Constitution calls necessary for any purpose. The Constitution doesn't say Congress is necessary, the President is necessary, the Supreme Court is necessary, none of that. The only thing the Constitution tells us is necessary is a well-regulated militia and necessary for this ultimate purpose. Question, do we have such things? And I say things because the Constitution talks about them in the plural. The militia of the several states is the terminology the Constitution uses. Why? Because there's supposed to be one in each of the 50 states. There should be 50 of these entities out there. Do they in fact exist? Answer, no. People will say, oh, it's the National Guard. Read the statutes, ladies and gentlemen. Go and take a look at how the National Guard was set up from 1903 on through today, and you will discover that the National Guard is, in fact, an adjunct of the Army or the Air Force, Air National Guard, all right? Or the Naval National Guard, all right? Navy adjunct. It's an adjunct of the regular armed forces. It is not a militia structure. It never was intended to be a militia structure. It was intended originally to be set up as a very large reserve for the regular armed forces. So we have a constitutional hole, essentially, because the founding fathers, if you recall, were very leery of the concept of a standing army in time of peace, which is really what's going on now, standing army in time of peace. Because they saw historically that standing armies of that type tended to be used by politicians of a tyrannical frame of mind to oppress the people. And that's why the Constitution makes it clear that the army appropriations, because it's the army they were worried about, not a navy, a standing army, the army appropriation can last only 2 years, according to the Constitution. Why is that? Because the House of Representatives is elected every 2 years. And the Founding Fathers wanted to be sure that a new incoming House of Representatives could refuse to fund the Army.
All right? We'll be back after the break. Don't lose that train of thought, Edwin. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Dee Dee and Dr. Vieira. Before we went to the break, you were talking about the connection between the Standing Army in the Constitution for a period of 2 years and the election of the House of Representatives for 2 years. regarding funding. I think that that's a connection that most of us have never made before. So if you could pick that up.
No, well, it's right there. It says in the Constitution that Congress has the power to raise armies, but no appropriation for that purpose shall be for longer than 2 years. And the reason was because the House of Representatives comes in anew every 2 years. And the Founding Fathers wanted to be sure that there was no appropriation, long-term appropriation, that some House of Representatives couldn't overturn all by itself. Because obviously you'd need the Senate to pass a particular bill, and you need the President to sign it. But if the appropriation dies every 2 years, then when the new House of Representatives comes in, if that new House says, well, we don't trust this standing army, the House is not going to vote for that appropriation, that's the end of it. The standing army disappears. So it left in the hands of the people, who were considered by the framers to have the most direct control over the House of Representatives, the House of Representatives being sort of the people's house, because the Senate, at that time, of course, the senators were elected by the state legislatures. They were really representatives of the states. This was to put the people in a position where the people, every 2 years, could decide as whether the standing army should continue to exist. Well, we've gone beyond that in practice. Now we have these very long-term appropriations in effect because they never overturned them, or they never refused to fund it. You know, the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about. And now these people are obviously planning. And I don't put kind of a malignant coloration on what they're doing. I mean, they're looking at a problem that's coming down the road at us very quickly, and they're doing what they're trained to do, planning on how to try to deal with this thing. And I just think the difficulty that they have is that they don't realize that a problem of this magnitude and this complexity, the last group that's going to be able to solve it is the Pentagon. All right? The way the Constitution wants this problem solved is through the militia of the several states, which are composed of what? Every able-bodied person from 16 to 55 or 60 years old, required to participate in some way in these entities. And so this brings into play in each state the totality of the state's resources, the totality, really, of the state's knowledge of local conditions, right? Something that you could not possibly communicate from the state to some central planner in the Pentagon. So we have a completely different type of control from the bottom up as opposed to control from the top down, and control by whom? By the people themselves, as opposed to control by some elite group of bureaucrats or some professional officer corps or whatever, you know, as nice as they may be and as patriotic as they may be. Nonetheless, they're aloof and removed from the people themselves. The Constitution was designed to give us self-government. And I like to quote this fellow, not because I approve of what he did, but because he puts it in a nutshell. It was Mao Zedong. What's his most famous aphorism? Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. That's what the Second Amendment says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear what? Keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, right? Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Why is that? Government is the mechanism for imposing legal force. It's supposed to have the monopoly of legal force. So if that's the mechanistic definition of government, what is a self-governing country? Well, it's one in which the people themselves control that centralized force mechanism. And that's essentially what the militia is set up to do. It's to leave that ultimate power in the hands of the people themselves, because that's the only way they're going to be a self-governing people. If somebody else controls the mechanism of force, that other group is in control of the government, and everybody else is being governed, not exercising governmental authority. So we don't have those mechanisms. And how do we go about dealing with that problem? Well, once again, you try to go to Congress, you're whistling down a wind tunnel, you're not going to hear the tune. I mean, forget it. Congress is not going to do anything about that.
They're not going to do anything because they've set up this behemoth called the Department of Fatherland Security.
Well, that's right. But I mean, they wouldn't. I don't think they would do anything, even if you could go there and convince them that it wouldn't work. I mean, you've got all of these contending factions there. You spend the rest of your life arguing with those people. And besides, as I said earlier, the militia constitutionally are state institutions, the militia of the several states. There is no such thing as a militia of the United States. Congress has the authority to call forth the militia for three purposes: execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, repel invasions. So the militia can be called into the service of the United States under specific circumstances, but they still remain state institutions. So the ultimate responsibility for these things lies with the states themselves. The Constitution makes that absolutely clear by talking about them as the militia of the several states, because that's what they were when the Constitution was ratified, of course. The states existed, and every one of the original 13 states had a militia, and that's what the Constitution is talking about, these structures that were there already under the Articles of Confederation, even before the Articles of Confederation, when the Constitution came into effect. So we're again looking at a situation where if the people want to regain control of that aspect of self-government, they want to regain control of the purse, they have to go to their state legislatures and demand an alternative currency be adopted by the state. If they want to regain control of the sword, the ultimate governmental power, on the anticipation that we're going to have some kind of economic and social dislocation, I don't think we're going to be able to avoid something there. And it might be very, very bad, obviously, if the alternative currency mechanism doesn't come into play soon enough. People need to go to the state legislatures and demand the revitalization of the true state militia within their states.
And we'll get to that on the, we have to go to the bottom of the hour break, so don't go away, because we're getting to the really very important part of how. So we'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. This is DB Kidd. I'm sitting in tonight for Jeff Rentz, who's taking the night off to go to a special event, and hope everything went well. Our very special guest tonight, who has so graciously agreed to stay on here for the second hour, because it is late on the East Coast. We're talking about one of the most misunderstood sections of the U.S. Constitution, and an issue, to me, right at the top, and that is the constitutional militia. The word militia, we know, has been vilified by the millionaires at organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center. And most recently, this past Sunday, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer actually hallucinated. I don't know what the word, Edwin, to use, but he said, quote, "If you look at the values and the historical record, you will see that the Founding Fathers never intended guns to go unregulated." And when I read that, I thought to myself, you know, this guy needs to read Edwin's book on constitutional homeland security, because nothing could be farther from the truth.
Yeah, he's delusional.
Either
doesn't know what he's talking about, or he's being grossly dishonest.
Yeah. But
all right, all one has to do is to go back and take a look at approximately 150 years' worth of statutory enactments in the colonies and then the independent states before the Constitution. And what you will see, and I have read all of this stuff, what you will see is the regulation that they had in place throughout colonial America was the requirement that every able-bodied free man, because of course they had slaves and women were not legally emancipated, every able-bodied free man from 16 to 55 or 60 years old was required to have a gun, a military-grade gun if he could get his hands on one, or at least one that would basically serve that type of function. The rifle, a bayonet, if he happened to be in the cavalry, he had to have a carbine and two pistols. It was all laid out. He had to have a certain amount of lead and powder and made up cartridges. I mean, the whole thing was specified. And if he failed to have those things, he was serially fined for every default. That's the history, not the Breyer history. All right.
Well,
the Breyer history is something coming out of Chicago or New York in the early part of the 20th century.
It was so ridiculous. But what we're dealing with, and, you know, Katrina, of course, is a good example. I work at home, you work at home. And watching it unfold, to me, was an astounding thing to watch. And it wasn't just New Orleans. It was the entire Gulf area. And I kept thinking to myself, if the constitutional militia had been up and running and trained to respond to something like a Category 5 hurricane that they knew was coming. And these buffoons, like Mayor Ray Nagin at the time, none of the what happened would have happened. The people would have been prepared. And we're not just talking about the collapse of our monetary system. There's great worry by people out there that the general government, the Congress, has their eye on the trillions of dollars in 401ks and retirement programs. They desperately want to get their hands on any asset that they can. And as things continue to erode economically, and, you know, the American people have their back to the wall, like you said earlier last hour, you'll have societal breakdown, and it won't do any good, just like it didn't do any good during Katrina, to wait for Mother Government to come along. And in fact, what did we see? We saw the people. I watched it live. Please send in the military. We need you to save us. And I thought, oh, my word. This is the state. I've got to grasp the concept and forget the vilification and the name-calling about militia and understand it. It's such a simple concept, you know?
And they were calling, please send in the military, and then what do they get? They got FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
And the National Guard, who really weren't prepared for this. I mean, New Orleans is a classic example because here was a city that was below sea level, right? They were dependent upon those levees. And apparently the levees were not in sufficient repair or they weren't sufficiently large or whatever. If you had had a militia structure in the state of Louisiana, one-tenth as large, because, of course, in the colonial period it would have been 100% of the able-bodied civilians. So it would, let's say, 10% of the population of Louisiana. One of the duties of that militia in their local, quote-unquote, homeland security would have been to make sure that those levees were properly constructed and maintained. And if the Army Corps of Engineers hadn't wanted to cooperate, then the local militia people would have simply taken on the job themselves. And don't tell me that they don't have qualified construction engineers in the state of Louisiana to do that work. And they would have had a duty as part of the militia to perform that function.
Not only that, but the militia, in watching, as you, I'm sure you know, there are several police officers who have been tried already and found guilty in shooting that poor man on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe that would have gone on if the militia structure was in place. Not to take over the military, not to take over the government or overthrow the government, but along the Gulf states, I watch 90,000 square miles of destruction. People didn't have medication, they didn't have water. But if the militia structure were in place, I believe we would have seen a very organized body of individuals, well-trained, well-equipped, to not only fight off the looters and the killers, but also to keep things from getting out of hand, as they did.
Well, you would have heard of looting if you'd had that kind of organization, because there would have been so many armed people. Secondly, another thing, you had some instances there of what one could call, I think correctly, police oppression or police brutality.
Yep.
And we've seen a lot of that in this country in other situations. And I like to tell people how that would be solved by the militia structure. As soon as you set up the militia, everyone, of course, has a duty to perform some function. Well, those people who are already in sheriff's departments and local police departments, state police, that would be their function. They would perform their militia duty by continuing to perform this uniformed service duty within the police or the emergency services, fire departments, what have you. But they would not be essentially self-policing entities. Every one of those individuals in the local police department would be a member of a particular local militia company that contained a number of people who were not policemen. And if one of those individuals engaged in some improper behavior, he could immediately be brought before his own militia company and charged with that impropriety. So I like to put it this way. We have the example of police brutality on Monday. this power-happy cop beats up Granny and takes her gun away from her. That's reported to his militia company on Tuesday.
Hold that thought, because I can hear barely music's coming. I'm sorry. This is the best example, even though it was tragic. We'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. This is Stevie filling in for Jeff tonight, and our special guest is Dr. Edwin Vieira. Before I get back to Edwin, if you check my website tomorrow, dv.com, I will be posting the links to some of the things we've talked about, including where you can get the very, very important set of DVDs, The Purse and the Sword. I can't stress strongly enough how important it is, because I've spent years reading Edwin's material and learning the real meaning of the Second Amendment. And I'll also post a link to an excellent column called The Fatherland Protection Racket. It's about Homeland Security. It was written by a professor, and he's right on the money when he says that the primary beneficiaries of the, I call it the Department of Fatherland Security, are politicians, lobbyists, and a flourishing Homeland Security industry. I personally would like to see it abolished. I think there are some members of Congress who want to see it abolished, but of course that's not going to happen in the current political climate. And other thing before we get back to Edwin, your state legislators, representatives, and senators, they most likely support some of this, especially the militia, because they live out in the community. They're listening locally. They know what's going on. But they have to know that you have their back, that you will support them, because this is for the most tainted issue that I've ever seen in my life, where state, you know, legislators and representatives think if you bring up the word militia, oh my gosh, you're some kind of nutcake or whatever. Anyway, Edwin, we were talking about, and it was so well publicized, about the National Guard going in and pushing this elderly lady up against the refrigerator and taking her gun away.
Actually, they were local. I think they were local police, but in any event.
Were they local police?
Yeah, point is, when the police, when you revitalize the militia, the police become a subset of the militia in the same way the Minutemen were or the Rangers were, these various subsets of the militia in the colonial period. And so when a particular policeman in that function that he's performing engages in some kind of oppression, he now has to answer to his normal militia company in the chain of command outside of that police unit. So the picture I like to draw is you have the act of oppression on Monday, you have the charge brought on Tuesday, you have the court martial on Wednesday, you have the appeal on Thursday, you have the punishment on Friday, and that will be the end of it. There will be one example of that in that unit, in that police unit, and then it will stop, because the penalties will be swift and sure and severe. Now let me get to this point that you made about the Department of, as you say, Fatherland Security, Homeland Security. There's an analogy here in what we're trying to do with the Federal Reserve. We can't abolish the Federal Reserve, so we use the states to go around it and return the power of the purse to the people. We can't abolish the Department of Homeland Security. I'd like to, but we can't do it right now. So we go around the Department of Homeland Security and have the states revitalize their militia. And it's a very important point. If you look at the Constitution, there is only one federal officer possible in the militia. Who is that? That's the president. The president is the commander-in-chief of the militia when called into the actual service of the United States and not otherwise. All other officers in the militia are state appointees. In other words, the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, FBI, CIA, whatever, any of those agencies in the federal government have precisely no constitutional authority to interfere with the militia. You follow this?
Absolutely.
All
I
right.
Take your call.
This was done by the Founding Fathers for very good reason. They didn't foresee, I think, the Department of Homeland Security or the CIA, but they understood the problem of central governments throughout history using centralized power to oppress the great mass of people. And they wanted the power to be left in the hands of the people themselves in their states. And obviously, if all of the officers of the militia are state appointees, then the only federal officer is the president, and he can only be the commander-in-chief under these narrow circumstances when the militia are called forth to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, repel invasions, and otherwise has no authority whatsoever over the militia, then who is holding ultimate control? Well, it's the people themselves down in their own states and localities. And this is the problem we have today. We have a huge number of people who don't realize what their constitutional authority is, what their real constitutional power is. They've bought into this demonization that's come out of certain subversive private organizations. Well, I'm holding a thing here that came out the a couple of weeks ago. You probably saw this, Stevie. This was from, I think, Time Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on the Internet, an article called Locked and Loaded.
Yep.
On the web and in militia groups, anti-government extremism is on the rebound. This whole concept that someone who talks about the militia is an anti-government activist of some sort, when the militia is a constitutional, that they are constitutional entities. This is how confused these people are trying to make it. Or Justice Breyer saying, well, you know, the Founding Fathers wanted gun regulation. Of course they did. Through the militia, a well-regulated, got that word? A well-regulated militia. And you can find out what a well-regulated militia is very easily by going and looking at the statutes those people passed. And what you find in every one of them is this concept that every able-bodied person not only had to have a gun, he had to buy that gun for himself if he could afford it. They wanted it to be his personal property. If you couldn't afford it, they'd get one for you. They'd supply it. They'd use tax revenues, or they'd take the fines that the militia collected for people who violated militia rules. They'd use that to buy guns and ammunition for the relatively poor people. But the basic concept was every person in that society, able-bodied male, had to be armed with his own gun.
Well,
total armament of society, not the Breyer view that only if the police and the armed forces are going to have guns.
Well, this
all
is
right?
One
they're completely
things-
upside down.
One of the things that you brought out in one of your earlier columns, probably back in 2005, 2006, that has always stuck in my mind, is that once a state writes the statute, and one size doesn't fit all, but once the state writes a statute and you're going to reconstitute the Constitutional Militia, suddenly you will have millions, millions of Americans who are becoming educated about the Constitution, about the historical role of the militia, and the true meaning of the Second Amendment. And I read that and I thought, what a great idea. Everybody who's going to be required to have the gun to be, you know, in the, and I thought, this is so wonderful. If we can just get one state to do this, I believe some other ones would follow. Because
I think they all would, because
common sense,
it's a solution to a lot of problems.
Common sense has got to tell them that we are in serious trouble. And as state legislators and representatives, do you think you're going to be immune from being pushed around by some federal dragoon? I don't think so. Not when things get bad.
No, and I think the point I made earlier is the key one. If you want state immunity from dictates coming out of Janet Napolitano's office, I shouldn't necessarily use her name, who's ever sitting in her chair, right?
Right.
Who's ever the head of Department of Homeland Security. If you want, as a state, to avoid those kinds of dictates and assert constitutional immunity from that, then you have to have these entities to be able to deal with your own local security problems. You have to be able essentially to tell Washington, we don't need you, we don't want you, we're following the constitutional mode. You keep your Homeland Security people in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the correct constitutional response. You keep them in Washington, D.C. because they really have no responsibilities that we have to be concerned about.
Well, and I know we're running out of time, and I wrote about this last May in a column. I wrote about the Mexican pirates versus the constitutional militia. Here in Texas, we are just, they're shooting across the border. They're killing Americans on, you know, lakes. They're pirates are out there robbing Americans who are out there fishing. This is, to me, the most unacceptable thing. And yet, I don't hear one person in our legislature, and we do have some really fine individuals serving in the legislature, but I'll tell you what, if I was the governor, I'd be telling the legislature, you get that statute done, we're going to have the Constitutional Militia, and you're going on, they're going on the border. This is what our state security is all about. We're not going to take this anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there are, you have to remember, too, D.V., there are lots of things that the militia would do besides that kind of security. As I like to say, there are roles for the militia, in the militia, even for Quakers and Mennonites, pacifists or whatever. There's something that everyone can do to provide for the security of their state. And it could be in a quasi-military role. It could be in the emergency response role. It could be in the role of heavy construction, whatever. You run across the whole gamut. One of the things, obviously, that the militia would be involved with right now is this alternative currency. If I were to set up that kind of a system, draw up the statute, I would have the state depository subject to the control of the state militia. Why? Because that's the people's money.
Absolutely.
And you want it controlled by the people themselves. So that would be one function. We bring in the IT experts, give them their militia badge, or their militia patch, on their uniform, and set them behind those computers running the alternative currency system. And then some of them in a security function, maintaining absolute control over that depository. You'd have others, if you were in Louisiana, they'd be doing problems dealing with the potential of the toxicity coming out of this BP disaster, which is still going on down there.
Yep.
Right? And they're totally unprepared for that, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and they have been, and it still is an ongoing disaster that's not getting enough media.
All right, so there would be a medical, toxicological, environmental protection role for the militia to function and to perform.
And it's our duty. It's our duty to, as free people in a free state, to guarantee the security of our state. This is one thing that bugs me about, Second Amendment rah-rahs out there. The minute you say you should be doing this, they go, oh, well, that's the government's role.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not.
Right.
We're out of time. Edwin, I know it's late back there. Thank you so much for being my guest tonight. Thank you very much. Thank you to the audience. And what's today? Monday, Jeff will be back on the air tomorrow night. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.